Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It is May 26th, 2016. This is episode 478. Yes. I'm your host, James Jones. With me today is Hockey Johnny.
Hello, hello.
What? Why are you a bad caricature of a Monty Python character? What are you doing?
I'm trying to come up with a signature thing. Like, Greg has his signature ahoy hoy thing. I mean, I'm trying to come up with something. You know?
So you just, you're telling me you need to find the Smithers phone answer to Mr. Burns one.
I'm just want to try it out.
I think it has something to do with Malibu Stacy.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of focus testing, so just bear with me.
Mm. You could go with the Homer yellow, or I don't know, Wuzzle-Wazzle? That's always a hit.
Guillaume, Wuzzle-Wazzle.
Wuzzle-Wazzle.
How are you doing today, Guillaume?
Pretty good. How are you?
Doing all right. Greg?
Yeah, hoi hoi, everyone.
Oh, Greg.
I guess I had to, really.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, we had to.
It's part of the brand.
We're working in a lot of Simpsons references lately, so I'm okay with this. Early season Simpsons references, the only ones that matter. It's the end of May, and we're about to roll into June, which means it's about to get to E3 time, and there's not a whole heck of a lot planned for this show, but I wanted to go ahead and say that we'll do some stuff, but mostly I wanted to point out that Nintendo World Report has a lot of things planned for this period, so keep an eye out for that. I need to talk to Neil. Hey, Neil, if you listen to this and I haven't talked to you, sorry, but it's time for new business. I got the segment title right this week.
Yay.
It's hard. It's hard being the host. But first up, Greg.
Yep. First of all, just say I did finish Mario & Luigi Paper Jam last week. Cool final boss and all that. And there's one thing I wanted to mention was that there's these sections where you sort of drill into the ground, which has been done in Mario & Luigi plenty of times. But then you kind of go up into the wall and start kind of zooming. You have a sort of boost power that Paper Mario makes possibly sort of zip about from place to place along the wall sort of thing. And I was like, This is pretty cool. This really reminds me of kind of boost plus spider ball stuff in the Metroid Prime games. And I'm still just trying to wrestle in my mind, is it really that similar, or is it just like when someone's really hungry and anything looks kind of appetizing? I haven't made my mind up yet. But it was a cool change of pace for some of the exploration in that game. But yeah, it'd be nice if I didn't have to ask that question on myself for things like that. But there it is. I've got an acquisition to report, and like John, who's just Ooh. Flogging all his games, I'm actually, you know, in the market to buy. I finally got my paws on Zangeki no Reginlev for I've had my eye out for an agreeable deal on that for a long time, you know, but not pretty much since it came out, really. And I finally got one. So, tested it out a little bit today. Lots of Japanese menus to get your head around, but I think it's pretty playable once you've consulted with a FAQ and got all that stuff straight. So that should be interesting. I'll get around to that eventually.
And that's that's from the developer of the Earth Defense Force video games.
That's
EDF. EDF.
Right. Yeah, this game was accordingly sort of dubbed by some people Earth Defense Norse because of its Norse mythology, or possibly Norse Defense Force, depending on your taste. Because it is pretty close to one of those EDF games, apparently. I've never played them, but you know, with Norse mythology and Wii Motion Plus hacking and slashing. It's obviously a game that can only be played in front of the telly, which I don't tend to do a great job of piling in hours to, so it might be a while before I actually have extended comments on that one, but I will get to it in subsequent weeks. But for now,
I'm super pleased because that was on the hunt list for the summer of too hot for games, and it's kind of hard to get.
Yeah, it's not the easiest. I guess it was always manufactured in limited quantities, just for so, you know, it's not been like really difficult to get if you're willing to pay a bit more, but I had a figure, I stuck to it, and 5 years later, the figure was met.
Victory.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm used to playing the long game, let's just put it that way. But anyway, the game I have been playing a bit of recently and ready to kind of talk about is Ultimate NES Remix. Another game I played played the waiting game with. I eschewed the option of saying, screw it, let's go with Hungry Hungry Hippos. I didn't actually... this is just another Simpsons reference for anyone wondering. But yeah, I always felt like the NES Remix thing looked like a cool concept, but I kind of like the idea of it being more portable than just off TV play. And then there was Ultimate NES Remix announced, but it was basically, you know, the near full price kind of retail game, which is out of whack considering, yes, it does kind of composite bits from the two Wii U digital games, but it's still only as big as one of them. You know, so instead of, whereas like the first one was a lot of like black box games, the early stuff, then the second one was, you know, some of the later sort of most popular games. This is, you know, sort of composite of the two, but there's still only 16 sort of titles that are used in total. So I thought, well, it'll drop in price eventually. And then 18 months later, here we are. So, you know, it got to a point that was sort of acceptable to me. I played it, you know, on the go. And it is very suitable for that.
I'm pretty sure at some point it became free on Club Nintendo, but maybe
yeah,
not
in the States it might have done, but not here. No. They've never quite embraced the sort of digital the games the same way as they did with Nintendo, with Club Nintendo in the States towards it. I guess because it went all digital, didn't it? That's the thing. I mean, we still had physical rewards even at the end. So it was a bit of a different approach. So, you know, I've finally got to it and I've enjoyed it. You've got like all the stars, not all rainbow stars, but all stars anyway. So which unlocks like a Famicom Remix, mode, which is the same game, but just you're running the Famicom versions. So I guess the FDS games have that extra base channel or whatever it was. And different title screens are sometimes visible. But you know, it's very sort of big name centric, this particular version of NES Remix, in terms of it's all kind of Mario, DK, Metroid, Zelda. You know, you're not getting your Urban Champion, you know, type of deals here. Which, you know, I guess, is probably a good thing in the main, but I would say, like, one of the constituent games that I probably had the most fun with was Excitebike, which I'd not played before. You know, so it was actually kind of a nice way of teaching me how to play Excitebike. But I guess the difference is Excitebike presumably has merit as a game, whereas apparently some of Urban Champion does not. you know, obviously with the other stuff that I've played many times, you know, Kirby's Adventure, Mario 3, all this kind of stuff, you know, you still have fun. They still choose some sort of interesting things to do with it. And then, of course, there's the actual, you know, you'd almost expect it to be more of the experience, but the actual remix parts, where you will do something like, you know, ascend the first stage of Donkey Kong as Link, wherein, of course, you cannot jump. So it's quite a lot more difficult or something like that. And those are kind of the highlights of it for me. Although I think structurally, I kind of would have preferred it, if it was more of in a Rhythm Heaven kind of way. And some of that's just because I love Rhythm Heaven probably. But, you know, what Rhythm Heaven does is you kind of have the four constituent games and then a remix which draws from all of them. That's what I kind of would have liked, rather than having like these, you know, list of tasks for each game that you unlock as you get stars, one after the other, if you want to keep going with that, which kind of gives you an overview of the various kind of aspects of that game's design. You know, it would have been nice to have like just certain little micro tasks from within one game and then a remix stage which pulls all of those together somehow. You know, a little bit more ambitious than just like swapping one character out or something like that. But, you know, it's still pretty fun, that stuff, you know, and it's at its best when it's really legitimately kind of synthesizing something out of these old NES games that, you know, it really appeals to you. But I feel like it's a bit safe the way it is, and maybe a bit more kind of advertisement-ish, if you know what I mean. You know, but a bit more kind of probably targeted not so much at people like us that have played most of those games to the extent that we have. But, you know, while the selection might not be, you know, the most apt for surprises or anything like that, you know, it is dependable. It is fun. And I had a good time, you know, pretty much exhausting its contents for, you know, quite a few hours sort of spread out over many small play, you know, sessions over a few weeks or so.
It's definitely not well suited to the long play. I remember when the first one came out, I got it and I hammered on it for the purposes of talking about it on the show and found it utterly tedious. And like there would be like one objective that would be really good, and then I'd slog through four or five crummy ones, and then I would get a good one. But I could definitely see on the portable it being a much more approachable experience, because the Wii U, you had to, you know, set up and get into your living room and go play it there, whereas on the portable you could just flip it open and close it as desired.
That was always my feeling. I always felt like, well, surely from a technical point of view, there's no reason why this wouldn't be on 3DS eventually, and it was sort of, you know, but as a retail thing, so that was a bit frustrating. It was like, oh well, it's, you know, it's more than I'm willing to pay, even though it's on the right format. But you know, eventually, again, we met, and I was pretty pleased with the outcome. But I feel like they could do more interesting stuff with this formula if they got a little bit more ambitious with the remixes. And of course, you could do different generations or mixed generations or whatever. You know, I mean, I love WarioWare. I love Rhythm Heaven. I do like that idea of kind of laying the groundwork with some constituent games and then weaving them together into something kind of surprising and fun.
I just wish it was more 9-volt. Than it is, you know. It seems very, yeah. You're pretty on. It seems pretty conservative in terms of how much it's willing to subvert the norms of the series from which it is originating. Even when they do things like here's Mario in a Zelda stage, it's still fairly conservative. I would have appreciated more of a sense of the zany.
Yeah, but yeah, it definitely doesn't have that. I mean, it's Indie Zero who did Theater Rhythm Final Fantasy.
Yeah.
They kind of have a line in nostalgia products, and then it's like EAD Tokyo overseer people, you know, that worked on 3D World and stuff. It doesn't quite have that kind of Sakamoto group, even sort of irreverence going for it. You know, it's more down the line kind of product than that.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, it's a lot. If you've got both the things in there, that's a lot of stuff. But it's not everything, obviously, right? Because it's like the best plus or some nonsense
It's still only 16 games, which I think is as big as the first one, mate. Or maybe they were 12 each. I forget.
Yeah, I think exactly. It was 12.
Maybe it's just a little bigger than one of the two. But it's not, you know, massively. But that's why, as again, I wasn't willing to pay much more than what it is, that one of them is on the eShop. It took a while, but eventually I found a deal on the physical copy that met that. And for that, it was great. It delivered what I was looking for.
I'd be curious which ones they cut, just to know, like, what games did they feel like, nah, this one can go.
Besides Urban Champion, I lost the name, the specifics, but I think Warriors Woods was missing from the second one, for instance.
That's, I can see that.
That's one of the later, like, it's very big name centric, you know, even more conservative, really, this one, you know, because it's just the Mario games, the Zelda games, the DK games, Punch Out's in there. That's kind of so excited by, like, they're kind of the biggest outliers, but other than that, it's the names everybody's expected to know.
And were they all games that are available in the 3DS eShop?
I believe so. Yeah.
I'm concerned that may have been the determining factor more than anything. Is this game on the eShop? Yes. Okay. It can go in. No. It can't.
Yeah. The advertisement kind of part of it. It's probably a legitimate point.
I'm glad it's enjoyable at least, because.
Oh yeah, no, it's very, you know, it's very well suited to portable play. I feel like it's kind of a shame, really, that I can understand why you might want to push it at retail, you know, to work that kind of lapsed gamer nostalgia market a little bit, you know, for people that might not be that plugged into the eShop, but that was like a year and a half ago or whatever it was that hit store shelf. a digital price cut probably would be appropriate, to be honest, because it's the kind of game that would be nice digitally as well. But, you know, I guess that it's not something that Nintendo does very often, unless it's a Nintendo Selects, you know, player's choice type of deal.
I would be willing to bet that this is one that shows up on the My Nintendo Rewards with a discount coupon.
Yeah, that is an option now, isn't it? Yeah, that's true.
That seems like a pretty likely candidate based on the stuff they put up there. Like, Tomodachi Life's up there right now. Like, I kind of see those two kind of the same sort of, this is a really mobile thing you might want to have around, but I could totally see people being resistant to paying full price for it. And that seems like a pretty solid candidate.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. John.
All right. So this week, the big release, the big Nintendo release.
Big release period, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is Overwatch by Blizzard, which is their class-based shooter, first-person shooter. So I haven't played a whole lot of it. I've been busy this week. But I did play the beta. I've spent some time with it. And I figured that people might be curious because, I mean, certainly on Twitter, you'll hear a lot about Overwatch. It's kind of like one of the biggest releases in a while because Blizzard doesn't really release games that often. So.
No.
Yeah. So the way Overwatch works is Blizzard is kind of like they, to me, they're sort of the North American Nintendo because they don't release a ton of games, but any games that they do release, they always aim them at a very broad audience. Within a genre, like they don't make multiple games within genres. They have like one game that's their MMO, one game that's their shooter, you know, that kind of thing. So they have they tend to release a small amount of very high quality games, and Overwatch is kind of along those same lines. So the way it works is it's kind of like I never played too much of Team Fortress 2, but it was a class based shooter as well. And so the way that works, what does that actually mean? Well, that means that you have different types of characters. You have offensive characters that, you know, can deal out a lot of punishment, but, you know, they don't have a lot of hit points. Then you have defensive characters where they're designed to, defend other players on your team and, set up choke points and stuff like that. And then you have tank characters which try to divert fire from the other team and just, you know, soak up all of their bullets. And you have support characters that heal, or they're like buff debuff, right? They can debuff the other team, and they can buff your characters, heal them. So the idea being that, most of the games are 6-on-6. So the idea is that, you can choose a character that kind of complements what other people have chose, when the match is being set up. So if you see like, you know, three of the people that you're playing with have chosen offensive characters, you might choose a defensive character or a support character. So, and when you're setting up a match, the game reminds you of that. Like, hey, you might want to choose, you know, you don't have any tanks, so you might want to put a tank character on your team. So it kind of makes sense. It sort of guides you when you're setting up a match. So there's kind of four different match types right now. There's like an escort match where you have, a payload that you have to escort to a certain point. There's kind of a control sort of match where you have to go and capture a certain point on the match and defend it. So they're kind of like your typical sort of shooter kind of things. So the way that the gameplay works is that, you know, you try to take out the other team, and you have, you know, your typical, your main gun, and then you have kind of like your backup, and then you have an ultimate. When you deal enough damage to the other team, it builds up a little meter, and you have an ultimate, where you that's a kind of a only for a short time. You can, you know, you have like 100% aiming where you will never miss anybody, stuff like that. And there's a whole bunch of different characters in it, all of them, they're all made to appeal to a wide audience again. So there's male characters, female characters, there's, you know, animal, you know, anthropomorphic characters, you know, kind of all across the map. They've really gone out of their way to make it appeal to a really, really broad audience. And it plays really fast. I got it on PC, which is for me, my PC isn't very great. The game still looks good. Blizzard games typically have a very cartoony art style. And so the way Overwatch looks, I would liken it to sort of that Pixar kind of cartoon style, where it's not really, really goofy, but it's kind of, you know, it's very cartoony, but yeah.
I would say if you're looking for an in-genre sort of idea of the sensibility of the game, you can really look at something like Team Fortress 2, where mm-hmm. that's kind of the mentality of the game. There's a lot of shared going on there, but that's artistically and sort of spiritually, like the personality of the game is very similar.
Yep. So it's like, so there's, you know, a good dose of humor in it, but that's across most Blizzard games. It doesn't really take itself too seriously. Some of the characters are really funny. You know, some of them are more serious or kind of, you know, they have a guy that looks like a paladin sort of thing. It's really, really a broad spectrum. But yeah, so in these 6-on-6 matches, I have to say that on PC, it runs pretty well on my PC. Because I'm playing it on my laptop, it's not that great. You can use an Xbox One controller with it. Works totally fine. You just plug it in and go. Although, really, I'd learned that playing with the Xbox One controller, it's playing a shooter on a PC is much better done with a mouse and keyboard.
Well, yeah.
I mean, and that's obvious, but I was hoping that maybe I could get away with it, because I really don't like mouse and keyboard control. I've never found it very comfortable. So yeah. I was trying to play with the Xbox One controller, and I'm just like, this is just controlling. It's controlling too slow for me. You know, it's just, the thing is, when you're playing against other players with mouse and keyboard, obviously this isn't anything, like, I don't know, but I was just like, I thought I could get away with it, but I really couldn't. I'm gonna go back to keyboard.
There are no settings to adjust the sensitivity of the controls.
I haven't dug into that yet, so I'm gonna see if I can maybe get it to be a little bit more tolerable. But out the box, I didn't like it. Like, I felt like I was just kind of turning too slow, and it just really wasn't. It wasn't even that. It was more that I just felt like couldn't really aim as quickly as I would be, as aim as quickly and as precisely as I could with a mouse. Like, with a mouse, I mean, you just, you know, you do a quick mouse scroll and boom, you're right around turning in the other direction. But, you know, when you're playing with a controller, it's just not like that. So.
Yeah, because, when you're playing with a mouse, like, you know exactly the distance that you need the mouse to move the mouse. Mm-hmm. To turn like 20 degrees or whatever, and you do it in a split second.
Yep.
Whereas, like, even if you've got sensitivity options on the joystick, you're going to be stuck with like that speed, right? Like, you're not going to be able to turn faster than you set it.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand not being a fan of the controls, but like, yeah, you're going to handicap yourself if you play with a controller, for sure.
Yep. You know, I play like Halo 5 on console a lot, and when I play Halo 5, you can tell it plays a lot. It's not slow, but it plays noticeably slower than Overwatch does on PC. Where you can tell, it's very obvious that you can tell that they have to tune it specifically. Now, Overwatch is on PS4 and Xbox One, so they did have to tune those console versions specifically for console controls. So
yeah, but also everyone is going to play with those same controls, so no one has an advantage, right?
Yep, exactly.
Sure, I just wonder if the game actually responds differently to the same inputs on the same controller if you're playing the Xbox One version. Like, if you could sync the two, that controller to two devices, and you press the same buttons, would the turning speed, the aiming stuff, behave differently on the two systems?
Yeah.
Well, if you won two matches at the same time, I would be super impressed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I win everything I do, Guillaume. Okay. So actually, John, the question I was going to ask you is, when you were listing off the special powers, and you mentioned one that made my ears burn a little bit.
Yeah.
Which is that your bullets would hit every time.
Yeah.
Is there stats-based aiming in this game?
No.
Because I will smash this computer. Okay, thank God.
No.
It's the worst feature in any shooting game ever.
Yeah.
Stat dice roll misses.
No, nothing like that.
It's just like you homing projectiles or something.
Yeah.
So you're not a fan of System Shock, of Deus Ex, of Deus Ex. Sorry. Of
I run pacifist stuff. I run pacifist runs at Deus Ex.
I see.
Yeah. By pacifist, I mean I break your neck with my hands.
And you can't miss.
Yeah.
Or does he just people just slip out of his hands, like, whoops.
I can't miss when elbow blades come out of my elbows into your neck.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So John, you said you played through the beta. which was, I guess, didn't have the full complement of features unlocked at that point. And you got a little bit of time on the retail.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to ask right now, this is a Blizzard game.
Yep.
So I know there is one. What is the content plan for this game?
The content plan, you know, that's actually an interesting question. I think they do have, they have to add, I know they're adding a competitive season mode to it. That's not in there. It's not in there yet. Right now, it's just you can just play kind of like the random matches. And you can also play versus AI. But yeah, that's what they're going to be doing. I'm assuming they're going to be rolling out new maps. I mean, it's, you know, it'll get ongoing support for a long time, I'm sure. I mean, if you look at other Blizzard games, I mean, World of Warcraft is going on for 12 years, and they're still making full blown, you know, game expansions for it. So, yeah, it'll be in the form of new maps and, like, adding features, adding the competitive mode and stuff like that. It's early days for this game, so I don't really think they've completely finished the entire full feature set that they want. But for the seasons, I think they're going for, like, 3 months. And that's kind of the way a lot of these online games are going. You can, like, get – the idea being that you get your character up to a certain – you know, you rack up a certain number of points in it. At a time, like a set period. Like Halo 5 does the same thing. They have, like, every month there's, like, you know, you can qualify for competitive play by, you know, you win like 10 matches in a certain mode, and you get like a little emblem and stuff. So, you know, it kind of keeps people coming back. Diablo 3 does the same thing. They do that, where you get your character up as far as you can in a certain time period. So there's that kind of stuff. Mm. But I mean, Blizzard supports its games really, really well. They don't.
Sure.
I mean, they only have like, I think six. They have six games right now. Like, but
that sounds right.
Yeah. But
yeah.
They're all. Super
I was just
popular.
Curious. I was curious how forthcoming they had been with what they've got. Because I know I had heard that they had talked a little bit about the extra game mode, which is presumably the one you were talking about now. But I hadn't really caught anything else besides that.
Yep.
Yeah. Is there? This game strikes me a little not. It's not to say that it is a MOBA, but certainly there are elements of that in here with the hero based gameplay and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Are all the characters included?
Yep.
Or do they league it?
No. All the characters are included. I think there's 24 characters or something.
Oh. That's more than I expected.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just. I mean, I don't quote me on that, but when. But I just, you know, thinking of the character select screen. For the four different types, there's at least six different types, or per like, you know, like offense, defense, support, the tank, whatever.
Okay.
There's at least six different types. There's about 24 different characters, I think. But the thing is, what the hook with this game though is, taking a page out of stuff like Heroes of the Storm, is they sell skins, right?
Yeah.
For cash money, so you can like just like cosmetic stuff like. Skins, you know, character emblems, you can get like different like voice packs for your character. So those things. So what happens is when you win a match, you get a loot box, which gives you these items randomly. So you don't have to pay any money, right? But if you want to like, if you want to buy like the really, really rare skins, the chances of them popping up in a loot box are like slim and none. So those are the ones that you have to, and you earn like in-game currency as you play, right? It's very much like Heroes of the Storm. Heroes of the Storm is the same way.
Gotcha.
As you progress, you gain in-game currency, and then on the in-game shop, you can either cash in that in-game currency for cosmetic stuff, or you can just pay it. Like you can get, I think the loot boxes, they come in packs. So I think, the most expensive one, like, I mean, some games I think go way overboard with this. It's like, you can spend $100 and get this. It's like, who the hell wants to spend $100? Like, that's more than I spent on the game.
Yeah.
But I think
especially if you're just buying random chests.
Yeah, exactly. And
which
I think that,
some games definitely do, which is awful.
Yeah. And I think the highest one in this case, I think for $50, you can get 50 loot boxes. I think that's the highest one. So at most, I think they're $1 a piece. So if you want
to
spend
$50,
you have
to open them all.
Yeah. So it's like,
do you have to open all 50 by hand?
I don't know that, because some games are like that.
I know.
Reavers. That was like that game.
Lost
was like
Reavers.
That. Lost Reavers. That game was like that, where you literally had to sit there, and like you had to buy every single thing. Like you couldn't, you know, there was no counter that you could increment to say how many you wanted to buy, you had to go in there and you had to buy the crate, and then you had to sit there and decrypt it and buy another one and decrypt it and buy another one and decrypt it. It was horrible. So yeah.
Amazing.
So I don't know. That's actually a good question. I don't know. Cause I mean, you know, I'll let you know next time I buy a 50 crate loot box. But typically, but going by what they did on, Hearthstone. Hearthstone's the same thing where you can just buy card packs.
Yep.
It's the same thing. And it's, you can just sit there and you click and, yeah, I mean, part of the reason why you want to see them get opened, right? That's part
sure.
of the
you want to do it, yeah.
Yeah, it's part of the hook. But I mean, I know in Hearthstone they make it really easy where if you buy like three packs, you just click on the next one, it opens. Click on the next one, it opens. Click on the next one, it opens. So it's very easy. But yeah. So overall, it looks good. I mean, I think if you're really not a shooter fan, I think that's kind of who they're going for. Because there's lots of different kinds of shooters, and the fact that it's a team-based shooter, so you don't have to, you know, it's not the kind of shooter where you spawn and you get killed immediately by someone sniping you from across the world, you know, which is kind of
well, you might, but
well, actually,
that's not necessarily what the game is going for.
Well, that's the thing. You actually can't do that because where you spawn when you die, you actually spawn back at like your home base, and then you go to where the action is. So there's actually none of that. And I think
that's very TF2-ish.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You spawn back at your home base, and I think you can get a portal back, generally back to where the action is. That was kind of one of the complaints I had when I first played it, was that you always had to trudge all the way back to where the current fight was. And the maps aren't huge, but you know, it's kind of like you're like, all right, now I have to like, you know, because when you, especially when you don't know the maps, you're like, all right, well,
right.
I have to figure out where the heck I'm going, and you know, but I've seen at some points where you can, like, there's a portal in your home base that kind of takes you to where things are going on. So I can't really confirm whether or not they do that all the time or whether that's something that other characters do. But yeah, but there is none of that just because you do respawn at your home base typically when you die. But yeah,
okay.
So yeah, and there's a lot of different things. Now, the one kind of thing that's interesting from a design standpoint is there's no clamber. So, and what that is you can't hop up onto something and then climb up onto it. So it's kind of old school in that respect where you can jump, but there's no climbing onto stuff. So it's, yeah. So that's just kind of interesting. I think they may have done that, maybe to keep the playing field a little bit more, you know, a little bit more, even. I think that's what they've done in this game a lot is they've tried to keep an even playing field because, you know, no one player can do everything. Like you
okay.
absolutely need support characters to heal you or else you're screwed. You need a tank player to, you know, absorb punishment and push things forward. I mean, you know, and that, like, you need all kinds, you need a good character mix. And also, you can change your character. If you get killed, you can change your character immediately. So you're not stuck with one character. So me, I'm kind of like, I usually play these games, like, I want to learn one type of character, but the game encourages you kind of not to do that. It encourages you to maybe, like, try characters you wouldn't normally like, maybe take a chance on some sort of characters. Like, I tend to get locked into one character. That's the character I know. That's the character I'm comfortable with. But Overwatch kind of tries to train you out of that behavior. Like, hey, you know, if your team is missing a tank character, try a tank character. So it's overwhelming at first because there's a lot of characters. They all have different attacks, different guns and stuff like that. Like, there's different ways to play each character, but it really does encourage you to play as many as you possibly can and make it easy to switch them if you don't like them. So
cool.
It's good.
Cool.
It's good. I would recommend it if you're looking for kind of a shooter game. I wouldn't say Overwatch is casual by any means. Certainly, I mean, it's
approachable.
It's approachable, exactly. So
cool. All right, well, John, when you get some more time on it, go ahead and give us an update.
Cool.
I'm curious about this one, although currently I don't have anything that can run it.
Yeah,
but it looks cool.
Yep.
Guillaume.
So I'm playing, for whatever reason, Star Wars Racer Revenge on the PlayStation 3. It's a PlayStation 2 classic that came out in 2002. And really what I'm doing is that I'm kind of doing a spring cleaning of my digital purchases that I bought,
classic.
You know, on sale. Yeah, I probably bought this one last year during, you know, a year ago May the 4th again. Just, okay, it's on sale, and without really thinking, I bought it. Not thinking that I've got plenty to play already. So I got into this not really expecting much, because I'm not a huge fan of the Star Wars prequels. I kind of, after episode 1, I was kind of done. I don't think I've seen episode 2 in theaters, or episode 3. And, so yeah, I kind of, like, I
well,
completely...
Well, 2 is the best one, so you should definitely go see that.
No,
definitely
no, it's not.
Go
I,
see.
I didn't say I didn't see it. I didn't see it in theaters. But then I caught up with it, and I learned that sand is rough, and that was enough. Like I don't
it,
know.
It caught up with you is probably the better way to put it.
Yeah. So so yeah, I wasn't expecting much, but I do like futuristic racing games.
Yeah, I gotta say this one totally got past me at the time. I didn't even, because you know, obviously Episode One Racer was quite a big deal on N64.
Right. Well, know, it was a big.
James, you know, James spoke favorably of his memories of that and all, and you know, I didn't have it, but you know, I was aware of it. I was kind of interested in it. It was just a bit, you know, I kind of felt like I had the real deal with F-Zero X. I didn't need it, and it was a high price to import. But yeah, the fact that there was a sequel around about the time Episode 2 came out is completely lost to my memory. I have no idea.
Yeah, well, it came out on PlayStation 2 and pretty much only that. This one didn't have an accompanying, you know, arcade game. So, you know. But yeah, so I didn't, and I don't think this game had as much of an impact as the N64 game, because I had no idea about this. The N64 game, Star Wars Episode 1 Racer, so like, is like the best selling futuristic racing game ever made. It's sold like 3 million copies. And,
it got a huge push, both from Nintendo and from LucasArts, and I mean, it was everywhere. Like, that game was really getting play, and also, it came out while people were still overly eager
for the
new Star Wars
content.
Yeah,
well, it came out 2 months before the movie even came out.
Yeah.
So
and
people
were
didn't
probably
even
already
have time to be like, oh, shit. This
people were probably
crappy.
Already lining up for episode one at that
the
point.
The pod race is great. Whatever you think
it
of
is.
The rest of the film, the pod race is great. So I don't know what that's got to do with anything.
And it's a really good game, but it also had this sense of speed that even on the N64 was like, this game feels really fast.
Right. Like, well, I watched some video of it.
Prohibitively so.
Yeah. I watched some video of it just before recording, and it gives me that weird nostalgic feeling for racing games on XC4 where the frame rate is not quite there, but it's quite speedy.
No.
And, you know, like the kind of, I don't know, N64 graphics, and it reminded me of, 1080 and stuff like that, except, you know, with Star Wars pod racing. Yeah, and from what I've seen, the original game had locations like Hoth and Tatooine and stuff like that, stuff that you could recognize. In the sequel, it's kind of weird because, okay, sure, the first race is set on Tatooine. That's the Mos Espa Open, and it's cool because, you know, it's a location that you recognize from the movies. And at some point, you see, like, oh, okay, that's Jabba's palace. That's cool. But then the second race is set on Sullust, which is the home world of Nien Num, a character, the character that's a co-pilot of Lando in the third movie. And
oh,
you're
yeah,
like, Yim-Yum. Wow, they had to dig that deep already for the second race, you know? And then, like, the third race is on Mon Calamari, and, like, oh, okay, that's the home world of it's a trap dude. And, you know, you expect a lot of, like, water and stuff like that. It's supposed to be an ocean world. And no, it's just a really white, really crystal looking place. It's really weird. So what I'm saying is that you're playing this game and you don't really get the feeling that you're playing in Star Wars locations, just because they're not featured in the movies, so you're not really feeling like, oh, okay, like I recognize this place, you know?
Yeah, they aren't really
you
iconic.
You know that there's some sort of, yeah, like there's some connection, sure, with the world, like these places have been described in the books or whatever, if you've read them, or sometimes they've been featured in other video games like Jedi Knight or whatever, but Jedi Knight actually kind of had the same problem of, like, okay, I'm in these places, but they look an awful lot like very generic plants and as in facilities, you know, there's an awful lot of crates here. And sure, there were crates in the original Star Wars, but like, Jesus Christ with the crates.
Yeah.
Right? And it just, it doesn't feel especially, the locations in the extended universe, quote unquote, Star Wars games have never been really their strength. You play in Rogue Squadron, you play on Hoth, and of course, like, immediately, like, oh, cool. You know, I'm playing the movies. You play even like on Bespin, and even though it's, you see it for a hot like 15 seconds in Empire Strikes Back, you still recognize it. A hot like 30 seconds in the special edition. But, you know, like it still feels like, oh, okay, I've seen this place. I know it. It's cool. It's from the movies. But when it's some jungle where the, kind of pig looking guards that with the rancor thing from Return of the Jedi, like who gives a shit?
Yeah, right? Yep. It's like it could be anything, but you're just being told it's Star Wars.
Mattel. Yeah. Mattel is the only people I know that give a shit.
Yeah.
But not
yeah.
Mattel, Kenner, excuse me.
Kenner.
So the locations are a disappointment, and I guess I should have expected that. Like, I mean, the settings are gonna be either from the prequels, which I'm not really as familiar with, or they're gonna be feel recycled, maybe, or they're going to be new, and it's kind of lose, lose, lose.
So I will say that there's a big hint to what's going to happen with this game. If you go look at the cover of it and its predecessor, both of them feature Anakin's pod racer, but the first one, Episode 1 Pod Racing, features him ripping around a corner on
Tatooine.
Mos Eisley, Tatooine, right. Yeah. The sequel features him on a yellow background with nothing else.
Yeah, it's like, not the most... Yeah.
It's a
pretty
telling.
Lean, yeah, I suppose. But behind that, there's still kind of a competent racing game. Like, I caught myself, like, I wasn't really into it at first, but then I got in tournament mode where you're expected to crash into other racers and kind of gain money that way and upgrade your craft. And that's always a fun mechanic, you know, like from off-road racing to... Like, whatever. Like, that's always been a fun mechanic of just, like, okay, I'm going to try to make first place to get the most cash possible to upgrade the crap out of my ride and then, you know, do the same on the next track. And so it's pretty good. It's got a good sense of speed. Of course, it's kind of muddy. Like, I mean, it's PlayStation 2. 2002 PlayStation 2. So it's, like, it's not that impressive today. But... you know, and as much as I crapped on the locations, they kind of have this F-Zero sensibility, you know. On Celeste, you do have, like, the tubes that you can go, like, roll all around in. You've got ramps, you've got some stuff going on. So the track design is alright. But, yeah, I don't know. Like, I enjoyed it more than I thought, but it's still not enough for me to stick with it. I finished, you know, set of four races, and I got it. I don't know, some trophy for it. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I finished the kind of default unlocked races in this game. And it was fun, but it's probably time for me to move on to something else.
Fair enough. Hmm. Then I think it's time for us to move on to something else. And that's me. Hi. So real quick, I finished it a couple weeks ago, but I forgot to mention. Finished Bravely second. Really dig that game. Hard to recommend, though, if you haven't played the first game, even though I think it's a better put-together game, just because I unfavorably compared it, or the comparison was favorable, but even being compared with Tales of Symphonia, Dawn of the New World is unfavorable situation for you. That is a game that basically took the story of its predecessor and just said, I don't know, we made it all up, it was all a dream, or whatever nonsense they said, and it just completely shat on the plot. But it was kind of requisite for playing that game, so you understood why everyone was there. In Bravely Second, they spend so little time explaining Bravely Default that if you're not there and also up to date, it's going to be tricky. And they kind of prey on the fact that you already care about these characters for some of the most impactful moments of the game. There's a side quest towards the end of the game that really goes like, hey, do you remember these characters? Here you go. That's probably one of the most cool moments of the game. But... It does stand on its own as a really solid game. It's just that the storytelling is so leveraged and the plot is so sort of evolved from that it would be difficult to just sort of pick up and go. I will say that overall, it flows a hell of a lot better. There is one stretch towards, I'd say, about two-thirds of the way in where you just need to go collect the asterisks. They're just sort of sprinkled about the map as side quests. That's a bit tedious because there's so many of the damn things, but it's totally optional. You could skip them. And then the final boss of the game is really cool. It's a really cool final boss. I just kind of dig what they did there. But so if you played Bravely Default and enjoyed it, even if you thought, God damn, the end of that game, you should go play it because there's none of that there. And I'm kind of surprised Nintendo didn't push this harder in North America. I know it did really poorly in Japan, and it did perceivably much better in the West, but they didn't really talk about it. You know, they're still pushing Fire Emblem. So I guess they only had room for one to release and only had room for one to talk about. So it's a cool game. I thoroughly approve if you've played the predecessor. If you haven't, I still think Bravely Default's worth playing. It's just there is a stretch at the end that is unforgivable. It's still a really good game. But that's not what I'm here to talk about, because it has been a tough week if you like Blue Bombers. It's been a really tough week. Deep Silver released what might be the worst trailer I have seen for a game.
The thing is, I've not seen this yet, so can you encapsulate why it's
sure.
so bad?
First, I just want to say I watched the trailer at work without sound, and it looked okay. It looked fun.
The game, I think the art style is garbage, but
yeah.
the and the explosions, as people have said, look like cheap pizza. But the problem with the trailer is that it's voiced over by what sounds like the president from Saints Row the Fourth, going like, "Hey kids, do you care about exciting games? Yeah, I'm talking about you who's looking at the screen right now. What if you could slide? Speed slide, air slide, standing slide, jump slide, spin slide. We've got slides for days. There's even a slide that makes you breakfast." Like, it just goes.
Are you reading a script right now? Or did you memorize it?
That's pretty close to what he says. Yeah.
It's just that compelling.
There's like a weird joke in there that people got upset about, like, you're going to make him cry like anime fan on prom night. It's just like, what the fuck are you doing? Where are you going with this? And it's so thoroughly out of style for what that game is that it's really jarring. And I'll be honest, I think the game looks kind of shitty looking. Like, Beck looks terrible. Beck's face looks awful. His character model is terrible. And I look at the old art from the Kickstarter and go like, God, why couldn't they've just done this style? Why'd they have to do that? And the answer is, of course, they're doing it in Unreal 3. That's why they had to do that. But it's a bad trailer. And I could say that it is a factually bad trailer because the CEO of Inti Creates agrees. And he's fucking co-developing the game. So if he says it's a bad trailer, it's a bad trailer. Thanks, Deep Silver. But additionally, the next day, because Capcom can't bother to stumble over their own feet, the first images of that Mega Man cartoon series that's being produced by... one of the Japanese anime houses, but it's their U.S. branch, so red flags ahead. The first two images of that game, of that show came out, and its description, and the character looks like Tron, like looks like a bad Tron knockoff you'd buy at a dollar store. Like they took the toys and they just copied the molds. It looks bad. And then the plot describes him going to school with his friends and having lots of co-characters like Mini-Man, which is actually named in bold in the thing. It's haunting. It is a haunting, haunting press release for fans of Mega Man, of which I count myself. So, how does somebody cope with that kind of heartbreak? And the answer is you go online and watch other people who are suffering way harder from this news. And just try to like go, well, at least I'm not that guy. Unfortunately, that kind of schadenfreude can only get you so long. And somebody will mention, you know, this game looks worse than this other run and shoot man game that's currently available. And that took me down a dark hole because I went and bought, on recommendation of somebody who is big into the runs and shoots mans, The Legend of Dark Witch on 3DS, which is an eShop exclusive game. It's also on Steam. But it is to go back to Bravely Second, anime is happening. It is a run and shoot man game where you play as a moe looking anime girl who's out trying to find out what happens to the source of energy that has mysteriously vanished. And you just go through a bunch of stages, run and shooting, until you get to bosses, which are also anime girls who all want to fight you because they're not just going to fucking tell you what they know about the energy source, and then you blow them up and they don't actually tell you anything about the energy source.
Is there a reason why you're going with run and shoot man instead of run and gun? Like, is Jim Jones involved? Like,
I'm trying to remember who I got the phrase run and shoot man. It's all one word, or it's hyphenated. As a way of describing all the games that are sort of in that Mega Man ilk. But this particular game is weird in a couple different ways. It's got a little bit of a roguelike aspect to it in that you have 5 stats on your anime girl that she can power up. One of them is speed, which is her speed. One of them is the fire pattern, kind of like a shoot 'em up, where it starts out just a regular shot and then it turns into a spread shot. Then you get more and more fire patterns on it. You can upgrade the power of it. You can actually, if you level up this gauge a lot, so basically you level up the gauge by killing enemies and you lose the gauge by getting hit. And once you hit certain tiers on the gauge, it's divided up in fifths, you can press A and lock it in and get that bonus, and then it resets all the way back.
Think of the options or whatever, not the options, but the way power-ups work in the first Gradius.
Not dissimilar. The challenge here is that's actually kind of a lot to manage. So I flipped it to semi-auto mode, where it basically, there's a predefined pattern that the game says this is the best way to do your upgrade path, and you can interrupt it if you want. But basically, you know, you upgrade your speed, you upgrade your fire power, you upgrade the fire spread. You can change the fire type. And so a lot of these have tiers of upgrades. And as you find these items hidden in the level, you sort of gain more, like you can upgrade this one stat more. You're also collecting the points that you get from killing enemies. You don't lose those if you get hit. And then at the end of the stage between them, you can dump those points in to upgrade, like how fast you gain level up skills and how many hearts you have, how many lives you get, stuff like that. What's weird about the game is it's actually super hard and kind of boring. Like occasionally a stage is pretty good. Most of the stages are pretty tedious, but there's no reason to stop firing, ever. And since the game auto-fires when you hold down the fire button, basically I just taped the fire button down and said, okay, I'm done.
Yeah, and the reason why I would say that the game is both tedious and really hard is because most of the time, like, yeah, there's no reason to stop shooting, and all the enemies are damage sponges. So you have to shoot them. And you only have to shoot them more if you don't have your upgraded shot.
Right. So, and that, what's funny is once I got to the point where I had the first level and I could beat it over and over again consistently. And I did in like 2 minutes flat, like 220, 215, 210. Like it was getting slow every time. I was just dumping everything into the stat that stays with you, the ones you buy between stages that upped the amount I collect every time to the point I had maxed that out. And then the game became super easy because at the start of every stage, it gives you a ton of them. And with that stat fully upgraded, you come out of like the little warm up area, super overpowered, and then just astroturf everybody, which sort of just completely broke the balance curve of the game. But I'm okay with that because the game almost never gives you hearts in normal mode. If you go to easy mode, you do actually get some. I can't imagine what they call it, like insane mode is. It takes away hearts as you play. I don't know. But it's, you know, the bosses aren't very good. Some of them have interesting patterns, but they're mostly stationary. The enemy design I actually kind of like. I kind of dig some of the art in this game. Like some of the characters look good. They kind of remind me of like Rainbow Islands, like that kind of art style in a way, just animate up a little bit. Like these kind of weird cartoony things. There's some Sega Genesis era games in there that kind of match too. Like this weird, really colorful, kind of bulbously shaped, really cartoonish things. It's interesting kind of art style. And the game has some pretty cool music that you'll never hear because you're shooting over it all the time. So we might do some of the music at some point as closeout music for the show.
Oh, it reminds me of Lords of Thunder, you know, that awesome soundtrack, yeah. Which is like totally drowned out by collecting the gems. It's like
yeah.
The gems have this really obnoxious sound effect, and you're just collecting them almost all the time. So yeah, it is
this game
that
actually
run and guns fall prey to for sure.
This game actually has, when you blow up enemies, they turn into, I can't remember what the term they use for them are, but they're basically butterflies, and like you may get like 60 from one enemy, and it just chimes. So it's just it's just constant shooting and just constant chiming.
It'd be nice if you actually had options to switch that off and stuff. I mean, even was like Theater Rhythm has chimes for when you're doing it right, on top of the original music. But you could switch the chimes off.
I might look into that. And occasionally you get the sounds of anime girls shouting Japanese at each other. It is like a 4-alarm fire in the spring of Moe games. So we've got all the Moe you need. So I had to kind of take the edge off with some more run and shoot mans. And I thought for sure that we played this game on as a retroactive, and we haven't. So I have 3D Gunstar Heroes or Gunstar Heroes 3D. I can't remember what.
So does that mean Guillaume's the only one that doesn't have it? Because John's talked about it, I've talked about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might be. I played Gunstar Heroes a super long time ago on my friend's Genesis because I didn't own a Sega system because I wasn't a monster. And like it's you can tell that it's of that era in a lot of ways, but that game is just treasured to hell and back. It's like the amount of fire you put on the screen, the fact that enemies in most places don't actually, you can't just kill the enemies. They're not waiting for you. They're just constantly spawning. The fact that his arm spins around in a socket like it's attached to a wheel and just sprays gunfire everywhere. The jump kicks, the throws, the grapple system. It's very, very, very treasury.
Well, it's the kind of the definitive treasury game because it was the first one. You know,
right.
That was the first game they made, striking out on their own and kind of, you know, laid down what their intent for the rest of their existence. Although, yeah, I don't really know what they're up to these days.
Nobody does. It's also can be a very difficult game. I'm stuck right now in this stupid stage where there's a board game and you roll dice and it seems like you always land on the same spaces and they're always terrible. So this game, unlike most of its run and shoot man's counterparts, is not very generous with checkpoints. Oftentimes it checkpoints you right before the boss you killed as opposed to right after it, which is categorically the wrong way to checkpoint your game. But I'm having a lot of fun with it. It's bringing back a lot of the memories I had of that game playing it.
Have you put the mode on where you can combine the guns any way you like? That's
no,
fine.
I haven't.
Yeah, that's worth doing. I mean, it's like, I guess it's cool to, you know, if you haven't played through it for ages, it's cool to play it more the way it was originally. But with the 3D classics in general, it's usually some extra mode that puts a different spin on it that's fun. And I really enjoyed that with guns. So just being able to pick your favorite weapon combination at will, you know, you can stick it on a harder difficulty to kind of balance it out a bit. And it's really fun.
As the only person who hasn't bought this, and as someone who hasn't finished the Virtual Console version, are the improvements, like, would they make the game worth buying again to try to power through it?
I don't
remember if you mentioned this, but is there like some sort of, can you play with Contra controls where you can hold down a shoulder button to stand in place and then?
Oh yeah, what that is is like it's a mode. There's two different characters, and one of them operates like that. The other one operates in a different way, and that is actually part of what I spoke about. With changing, you can actually switch characters as well in that mode on the fly. So effectively, it just becomes a control option instead of a character option. So that's built into the mode where you can freely toggle the weapons as well. So, okay. You know, there is that, I suppose. But, it's definitely the best version of the game. You know, for me, it looks great. You've got these extra options and stuff. But, yeah, it is still that game. I mean, I can't imagine it's going to really change your opinion of it to a great extent.
Yeah, I'm going to spend some more time with it. It's like I said, I've played this game before, so it's not like I need to just jam through the whole thing. I know what's coming, let's put it that way. But it's a cool game. It's nicely done in the 3D port. It's pretty cheap too. It's $6. Granted, is it on that collection? The Sega, the retail collection Sega put out? I'm sure it is.
So, it is not.
Oh my god. Why no. Sega?
But they've got like three different fantasy zones, so.
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody loves their fantasy zones.
I like Fantasy Zone 2 on 3D.
Do you
Classics.
Like three
really
different
good.
Fantasy zones in your package?
I've yet to play the other one.
Do you fantasize know. About nothing but fantasy zones? Because guess what? Sega's going to deliver. Oh, well. On that, at least I'm not playing Mighty No. 9. And on that, we're going to take a break. So, we come back, it'll be time for your listener mail. And we're back with listener mail. I need to think up a new opening for listener mail. But you could send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You could tell me how to open listener mail with more variety. I'd appreciate it. But.
Pathetic.
First
just
email.
Begging for a jingle, James, with vocals from yourself.
I'm trying to diversify the show's sound. But it's hard. We're stuck in a rut. We need your help to pull us out. But Greg,
yep.
Can the first email pull us out?
Well, we'll see, won't we? Matt writes, do you think Nintendo's next mobile app needs to be an actual game for them to be a legitimate mobile contender? Also, if it is a game, is it required to have a well-known Nintendo mascot featured in it for it to sell? Thank you in advance. Keep up the great work.
So this email got shunted a few times off the list, as you could probably guess.
Yeah.
Because we know what their next games are going to be, and they are games.
Yep, Animal Crossing and Fire Emblem, so.
Well, definitely Fire Emblem is a game. Did they say definitively that Animal Crossing was?
I don't know.
Because I would argue that in a lot of ways, Happy House Arrest isn't really much of a game. Because you can as long as you put the items that the character tells you they want, you can basically win. So Dan Reichert did a fantastic one where basically they were told, like, I need a space for my baby. It has to have a crib. So he basically put down concrete walls, concrete floors, put the crib in the middle of the room and surrounded it in space heaters and fires. And she came in and gave it the highest score possible.
So, that's awesome.
So it's not much of a game. But I don't think if it's Animal Crossing, it needs to be a game. I think if it's Animal Crossing, it just needs to be Animal Crossing for it to be a legitimate success.
Yeah, exactly. Animal Crossing isn't much of a game. It's more of a curation kind of
Well, and some variants are more gamey than others. I mean, there are game elements in the core Animal Crossing experience. Mm-hmm. Fishing is a game. Treasure digging is kind of a game. It's kind of a toy. Yeah, I mean,
it's RNG,
goes...
but...
Nice. It goes to... To what one, I'm trying to remember who it was that wrote this up recently, but sort of was describing the culture of the various players and that Nintendo still has the toy maker culture in play. Like, it's more of a toy than a game.
Well, they always described it as a communication game, so it's always seemed like such a likely candidate to be on a platform where, you know, the communication is built into the device. I think that's, you would think it'd play up more on the kind of people. You know, visiting each other's towns or, you know, like, maybe the economy elements in it, you know, trading and things and, you know, that kind of, just, would you've got that level of possibility for integrated communication, they could really explore those aspects of the game a lot more than just kind of the pure collecting kind of aspects that you've had before. Right. I would have thought, maybe more things where if you're going to collect a whole bunch of stuff, you've got to, you visit other towns and interact with other towns to get that. So I know they've done that with the fruit in the past and that kind of stuff, but seems ripe for really kind of radical expansion. on mobile. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it has to be any more of a game than it's already been. It'd probably just emphasize the communication aspects more. But it's such a natural fit. I think we always thought that Animal Crossing was coming. I don't know whether you'd class it as a Nintendo mascot or not, but it's certainly one of their biggest selling properties at this point. So, it's just a fantastic fit. Fire Emblem, of course, is not like a mascot type of deal, but again, it's been rising in popularity. And I think that is the one case where, you know, we've seen with something like Miitomo, I think it's achieved their aims. It's got them on the map. It's got people signing up into the My Nintendo service and all that kind of stuff. Decent number of downloads, but you know, the usage is dropping off. It doesn't aggressively try to get people to part with their money. So that's not really the point. I think something like Fire Emblem could, not necessarily should or will, but could be used more to aggressively kind of get the real power players to part with their money, you know, to maybe advance the game faster or, you know, have some special perks or whatever else. I'm not particularly up on mobile games, so I don't play them, so please forgive me if I say anything woefully inaccurate about this sort of thing.
It seems to me that the mascot is not really... I think that a lot of people who came after Nintendo in the console space thought, okay, we need a mascot, we need a platformer. And then they realized, no, wait, maybe we don't. Like, yeah. Sony had Crash Bandicoot, I guess. Microsoft tried something with Blinks, but then they realized, oh, wait, Crash Bandicoot sold, but those were not the big sellers. Certainly, yeah. Blinks was not the big seller. Mm-hmm. And it just seems to me like Mario is kind of the aberration, and Sonic as well. Although, yeah, Sonic is an aberration, of course, but it's also an aberration in the sense that it's a popular mascot.
I think the word you're looking for is abomination.
Abomination, yes.
They also just wasted him at the crucial moment, you know, where they blew all that momentum they built up in the North American market. In the 16-bit era, they just burned it all in the 32-bit. And, you know, I guess by the time Dreamcast and Sonic Adventure came along, maybe it was too late, or maybe that decline was inevitable because of what you're talking about. Just the gaming market was changing, but also just pop culture in general was changing. I don't know. There was something about that particular, everyone was at it, not just the platform holders, but, you know, every developer you can imagine was trying to make a mascot. James touched on the fact that someone tried to make a mascot out of the president's pet. At that time,
yes.
I mean, it was just very, very silly time, really.
It was. Yeah, that's actually a really good point, because there were a ton of like weird things that were like, this is our, like, somebody thought, and I have a book that is a testament to this. Somebody thought that Gex, a smart mouth gecko, would be enough to be a mascot, and
oh yeah.
Gex is to use John's word, an abomination.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
it's it's a bad game starring a worse character, and they fucking tried. But I think there's the word mascot here, and I think maybe there's kind of the second meaning. This is the person who represents our brand. This is how we put our face forward. And there probably is some need here for Nintendo to leverage a brand that has a broad recognition. Because even if you came in sort of a post-Nintendo era, or if you're the term they use, the lapsed gamer, you know who Mario is. So Mario has some cachet built up over the years of just making good games with Mario's face on them. And that is a bonus that has market value, and it will make people interested in whatever game comes out that stars Mario.
Well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? I mean, a lot of there's been a lot of sort of rumblings about, oh, you know, some of the misplaced reaction to the Miitomo reveal about, oh, they're not really trying, it's not Mario, or whatever, you know, that kind of silly stuff. But there is a question about how much, if or when Mario is deployed, which I think it's pretty safe to assume he will be, even though he's not going to be in one of the first three now. Mobile apps. You know, how much of it is going to be like a real Mario game, or how much of it is going to be him in his mascot capacity of like, well, you know, he's been plastered on just damn near everything over the years, Dr. Mario, sports games, etc., etc. You know,
and he's been in mobile games, except not on mobile platforms. He's been in Puzzle and Dragon.
Yeah, no, exactly. Right. No, exactly. Yep. So you've already had that kind of thing where you take the mascot, you take the characters, the colorful world and all that, and just slap it onto a game design and formula that was born out of the mobile space with the Puzzle and Dragon. So, you know, that's the point. I mean, it seems interesting to me. Will they just do that, or do they feel like, you know, they'd really be faced with these sorts of accusations of the fact that they're sort of half-heartedly pursuing the mobile business if they don't try and do something genuinely more Mario? But then, of course, you run into the very tangible problem of, like, well, those sorts of games don't generally seem to do that well on mobile because they're not set up for it. They're not, with the lack of tactile controller and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, and Nintendo's been pretty straightforward about the fact that that kind of game doesn't work right. Like, I mean, I don't remember if they've actually explicitly said it or if they just hinted at it strongly. I think the reaction of, well, this isn't, why didn't they start with the mascot, is idiocy.
Because it's so simplistic and just ignorant of what has gone on with Nintendo's successes.
Right,
in
if
the
you,
you past
just
10
you just don't
years.
Know what just because you don't know what Miis are doesn't mean they're not important. You ignorant, ignorant fool. But I think starting with Miis is actually a pretty smart choice. It establishes them on the platform. It also lets them create an icon for your character if you weren't involved in the Nintendo Network ecosystem.
Yeah, you could potentially share your Mii with other apps that they create.
Oh, and you will. Absolutely will. Because if you signed up for My Nintendo and you didn't already have a Mii attached to your Nintendo Network account, if you go to Nintendo.com and sign in with your My Nintendo account, guess what shows up in the top right corner?
Mm-hmm.
With little alerts telling you when you need to go cash in your points. Like,
yep.
It's just your Mii chilling out in the corner.
It's all a big conspiracy.
Yeah, it is a big conspiracy to get you to sign up for stuff. But I don't know that it needs to be anything special. You know, it needs to be good, whatever comes out, and it needs to be compelling. And if that makes it a game, then it should be a game. But I don't know. To Greg's point, I'm not super up on the mobile scene. Hello, my fellow students. Kind of stuff. Like, I'm not up on all this new video gaming on your phone stuff. So I don't necessarily know what's gonna work super great. I know that I've played some strategy games on my phone and found them kind of wanting. And I know that what I like out of a Fire Emblem probably won't work how I deploy my phone as just sort of like a momentary time killer. So I want them to be very careful about what they make and not just try to replicate the existing gameplay. And they said they won't, so I feel pretty good about that.
There is that, but one thing I wanted to ask though is that, do you think Nintendo's got more to lose than your average mobile developer in the perception stakes, in terms of, you know, if they go for the really, yeah, some would say sleazy, kind of aggressive monetization stuff, that you know, that would hurt Nintendo more than for, you know, just another developer that's just kind of, well, that's the mobile space, that's expected. You know, I mean, this is the company at least used to say things about, when we do when we do a game in a box, it's meant to be complete, it's not going to have some sort of predatory DLC kind of plan attached to it or anything like that. You know, they've traded off this sort of reputation before of being kind of, you know, sort of getting what you pay for. You know, so I just wonder whether if they handle it wrong, it could actually even reverberate beyond the mobile part of their business.
I think it would certainly potentially hurt their perception in amongst the enthusiast crowd. I think that's already kind of in a weird place right now anyway. But there is certainly this sense that, well, hopefully Nintendo doesn't go out there and just be assholes. And there are definitely people who solely exist in the mobile space by being monsters, who just are you know, any of the write-ups now you read about whales and how they, you know, there was an article that spoke about how they know everything about whales because the incredibly predatory terms of service you agree to, where they can just look at your phone and find everything. And they go and they find out your Facebook account, and then somebody actually goes and looks at these people's Facebook accounts and figures out what sports teams they have, like, league-level licenses of, that they should make sure they have lots of DLC items for, so people will buy them because they know they're susceptible to buying clothes. That's straight up somebody at an office going to your Facebook page to make something that preys on you as a person. Like, that's really sleazy. And yep. Nintendo would be rightly castigated if they behaved in even remotely similar behavior. But I don't think they will, because we still haven't had a chance to talk about this yet, but they appear to have the intention of diversifying as a multinational, multi-platform entertainment company. So,
yeah, and therefore,
that keeps them from becoming...
And that goes to my point again. You wouldn't want that kind of, if you're going to be in the movie business, if you're going to be in the theme park business, whatever else, and in each of those, you're trading off this kind of, yes, the specific characters and stuff, but this kind of general perception and sort of good feelings and nostalgia that people mm-hmm. have for Nintendo. Yeah, you can't go that far, I don't think, in the mobile business without compromising that to some extent. And then, what you're trying to leverage in all these other ventures isn't as valuable anymore. So I think Miitomo has its own reasons for being casual about not monetizing. Like, it's more about just getting people in the door, on board, in the system
right.
for my Nintendo. But I think even some of these other ones, yes, they'll go significantly further than Miitomo, but I can't see them going that far. I certainly
Well, and if you're a company like Supercell, who has 4 games, I think, and they're all spaced out by about a year, and they're mechanically pretty similar. I mean, they're not the same. That would be reductionist of me to say, but there's definitely some overlap on mechanics. You can probably be a little bit more aggressive on this kind of thing. If you're like some of their smaller competitors that really only have one successful game, you have to be that kind of aggressive because you have one income stream and you need to tap that out while you're trying to make the next one. A diverse company doesn't necessarily have to try to get, $2.1 billion of revenue off 3 mobile apps. Nintendo can afford to make a smaller amount on their mobile app space as long as it's a profitable addition to the bottom line, to the degree that their investors are satisfied, insofar that they have to satisfy their investors knowing that the majority of the stock is still in internal hands.
Yeah, so, I mean, they have larger aims than just necessarily right. making money. They want to make money, but they also want to, they want to get their characters out there. They want to, there's that kind of popularity and, like Greg said, the goodwill that they kind of
It's a company health thing.
Yeah.
This if you think of Nintendo as just going mobile, then that's probably, to use the word again, reductionist based on what they've announced just recently. It is part of a diversification strategy. They have seen that the home console space and the mobile and the portable space, to differentiate from mobile, are not what they were 5 or 10 years ago. So they need to be a more broad-based company. And being in mobile is part of that. Making their own movies internally versus just licensing is a huge part of that. That means you get way more of the money in the end if you're successful. And you build new talent, you develop new technology that you can license out to other people. Like, it changes what your company is at a really foundational level. And you don't, if you're that kind of diverse, you don't have to try to be a super predator in anyone's field. You get to be the omnivore. You get to just eat whatever's around and be okay health-wise. So, yeah, I don't think they'll ever get there. But, John, I haven't really heard your thought on the idea of the mascot versus the core franchise versus the does-it-need-to-be-a-game stuff.
I don't know. I feel like we're living in kind of a post-mascot world. I mean, there's so many big...
Mercifully.
I mean, I really think now it's more about like gaming brands and franchises than it is about one particular character. I mean, you can pretty
much... Are you saying the Zool won't sell the Amiga ST?
I think that's accurate. I think it's... I mean, especially now in the days of, reboots where, you can completely reboot a franchise and, you don't need to... You don't have to hinge a franchise on one particular character, or you have like a lot of the big franchises now are almost like ensemble pieces where there's like many different characters that, especially trying to, like I talked about earlier with Overwatch, trying to be inclusive. A lot of franchises tend to have a lot of different kinds of characters that people can, that people can attach themselves to. But yeah, I don't think. I mean, you're not going to see any sort of. I think if you're going to see Mario, it'll be used in some sort of kind of ensemble thing where he is one character among many in some sort of harmless genre. Like, I don't think you're ever going to have, you know, Mario. I mean, you might see a Mario Kart game, maybe, like a smartphone game, but I think that's about as far as they'll go.
They're never going to make a tight platforming game for Mario on a mobile phone.
I don't think you'll ever see Mario Runner, in other words.
No,
Mario Base Builder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think you'll ever see that.
That's a good call on that one. In a lot of ways. And I apologize. Yeah. It's the Atari ST, but I was right. It's an Amiga game. So, CD32 specifically. But I think it's time for the next email. So that All would right. be John.
Yep. All right. Eric in Chicago writes, "Hey, RFN. So I started thinking about the NX today, and I came to the conclusion that everyone is overthinking what is special about the NX. It's not virtual buttons or feedback or motion controls or gimmicks. I think Nintendo has learned from the Wii and Wii U and realizes that those technologies have either A, had their day, or such as on the Wii, or B, never caught on to begin with the Wii U. What makes NX special is that it will be truly cross-platform between portable and home console, nothing more, nothing less. Think of it like the PS4 and the PS4 Neo. You'll have your baseline game that looks good on the PS4 and your PS4 Neo version that is the best graphical version, the same effects as the NXP and the NXC, portable and console. This is a hook, no gimmicks, no motion controls, nothing that conjures up the old Wii memories."
But so basically, Eric actually wrote a much longer email than that. But basically, his point is that it's important for Nintendo because they're, quote, the kings of the portable space, and that if developers want to play ball, they'll be on the console version for free, and they'll want to play ball because they're kings of the portable space. We've kind of talked about this idea that it's one and the same a lot. It's something that comes up a lot of times. And yeah. this is sort of like the driving theme of why people are, we don't know what NX is. Okay. I've said it.
We really should make a pre-recorded Sting thing for that. We really do. We need it.
Just a siren that goes
yeah,
off.
Yeah, just something.
We do not currently know what the NX is. We do not currently know what the NX is.
Yeah, it might come to that.
We do not currently know what the NX is. We do not currently know what the NX is.
There's sort of this driving rhythm to this conversation that they'll be on the handheld and the console, and you get it for free, and so developers will want to be there. And I kind of want us to talk about that. Like, it seems to be sort of like the core identity of the idea that it's the same platform.
I have a hard time imagining that third parties, and by like major third parties, EA, Ubisoft, etc., would be interested just because the Nintendo NX is both portable and home Nintendo console.
No, that's a Japanese.
They're not interested.
It's a Japanese thing. Huh? That would be why the people who would care is Japanese third parties, because that
right.
is still the biggest part of the dedicated gaming market in that particular country.
Sure, but so looking at the Japanese market then, I have a hard time thinking that Konami would be all that interested.
In making games, full stop? Yeah.
Can it play Pachinko? Yeah. Can it play Pachinko? No,
like,
okay, we're not interested.
Who's left
Square
even developing
and Capcom,
for the 3DS?
You know, it's really...
Square,
yeah,
Capcom,
and Square
Sega,
is really
Atlas.
Just like the one game almost. So you've got Square, you've got Capcom, you've got Atlas, so that's basically it. So that's not a whole lot to...
No, well, that's the point. I mean, this is to James' point about why they're diversifying, is that, you know, you look at what's going on in their home market, you know, it has been shrinking for a while, but at the same time, I think, you know, like I said, they have sold 20 million 3DSs in Japan alone. There is still a market there that survived mobile gaming, which has been a big thing in Japan for a lot longer than it's been anywhere else. So there is, I think there's still value in protecting that market still. But yeah, I think it makes it easier if you're not splitting resources, you know, to two completely separate platforms. And we've seen that already I mean, a lot of the thinking about, you know, that Eric is talking about has come out of the fact that Nintendo, we know there are certain things we do know. Well, it's very much we don't about NX. We do know that they've been consolidating their development teams. We know that the barriers between portable and console development within Nintendo are being broken down. All this kind of stuff points to one common platform, presumably, but with multiple devices that would be a part of it, a family of systems, as they like to say. That is, I think, a reasonable sort of position to take, I think. But I guess the one thing I would say to Eric is that it wouldn't, having a common platform, you know, amongst all these different devices wouldn't necessarily preclude some of them maybe offering some of these more, as in his words, gimmicky type of things, but they wouldn't
but the
difference would be there that the game would presumably be, you know, maybe designed in such a way that that isn't the only way it could be played. You know, it would be an optional type of thing. Like, but, you know, that we already saw, you know, Mario Kart Wii, for instance. I mean, they made a big deal out of the Wii wheel and all this sort of stuff, but you didn't have to play it that way. You could just play it the regular old way if you wanted to. But, you know, in this case, you might be, well, if you've got the motion, I mean, I would imagine there'd be plenty of motion stuff built in standard to things there. It's not really anything that special anymore. But, you know, something maybe individual to particular devices to make the Nintendo loyalists, the power users go out there and buy multiple devices in one platform, even though you don't need to, you know, like play completely unique games or anything. But, you know, many of us have bought DSIs and new 3DSs and all the rest of it, so I mean, it's not exactly as if they haven't done that sort of thing before.
Are you saying we're the problem?
Well, it's just reality. You know, people buy what they want. You know, if they didn't feel like it was worth it, they wouldn't have bought it. But that
fuck consumerism.
But that demonstrates something to Nintendo
and Super Mario Brothers 3
that they have a user base that's willing to buy multiple devices, even when it doesn't really gain them access to a completely unique library of games to go with it.
Right, but that user base is kind of dwindling, and that's what
need
to reverse.
But that's why you need to milk it harder, though. You need to milk the ones you've got left harder.
Double down.
That's really
what
they're going for. Like, Amiibo is trying to milk the existing user base. I think that the NX, they're trying to reverse the trend. They're trying to expand, for
sure. I think you need to attack it at both ends. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if you have a unified platform, it's easier to do that. I think the problem is, having the separate platforms made it very difficult for them to do things with Wii U that, you know, that really kind of worked, because, I mean, they were so, you know, rooted in Japan, and yet, you know, Wii U virtually never had a chance in Japan. You know, you look at the way that market's been going for a long time. And to some extent, it seemed like it was aimed at Japan. Like, it was trying to solve a problem for, you know, Japanese, families, you know, they might only have like one main room, and you want to overcome the problem of like you're hogging the TV with a console. Maybe that's why they're not as popular. But you know, well, Wii U kind of put that to the test, and the results didn't come back very positively. But that's the thing. I mean, I feel like you don't have to have, if you have this platform with multiple devices, it lets you kind of go for multiple objectives at the same time more easily, in terms of, well, the stuff for the American market, stuff for the Japanese market. It's not ghettoized to one platform or the other. It's just you can pursue those aims at the same time. You know, and it seems like they've done all the kind of internal heavy lifting into the consolidating these teams and, you know, breaking down those barriers to do this. So, you know, this is supposed to be when all that work pays off.
One of the key things in Eric's email is that he says that DNX will be truly cross-platform between portable and home console, nothing more, nothing less. So it seems to assume that any game that can be played on the kind of the home console version or whatever, the home version, would be playable portably. Mm. And what were the titles that Square Enix was teasing or flat out said, like, oh yeah, that's coming to NX? Like, it wasn't Final Fantasy 15 one of those?
Dragon Quest.
It was some high-end stuff, let's put it that way.
Some high-end stuff, right. Some high-end stuff that is difficult to imagine would be playable in a portable, especially a portable made by Nintendo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We still don't know how that would work in terms of, is it, you know, sort of streaming tech, not unlike the Wii U, where, you know, the actual computing power would not be in the portable you're playing on, how they're going to do this stuff. This is where, you know, the not knowing the practical details kind of breaks down how, you know, much you can really look into this and say exactly how they're going to achieve it. It's just a broad...
I was going to say, like, if it's tethered to a bigger system, then it's not reportable. But then again, like, the system could be a backpack. You carry a backpack around with its own power cell.
It's just exactly in the shape of a GameCube, and you just carry it around with the handle in your left hand, and then, yep, you know, it wirelessly streams to the portable in your right hand.
Just hop in the Ecto-1.
All those GameCube shells are taking on an Atari Jaguar shell second life. So,
yeah. I mean, it could very well be that you can stream to the portable, but then also it'll play its own games.
It's got to be able to survive in a place with no internet. Otherwise, it's not a portable, because you can't use the internet on a plane effectively. And mm-hmm. if you can't play portable games on an airplane, then this world should be destroyed. Why do we live anymore?
Yep. Exactly.
So I'm still not on board team. These are the same things with cross-platform play. It doesn't make sense to me at this point. Like, there, you would have to make either huge concessions on the portable game, or on the console version of experience, or you'd have to have an incredibly powerful portable device.
Yeah,
and
I mean, for my part, I've always felt like, you know, don't bet on it being that powerful, you know, like that's always been, I just feel like, well, you know, think of Nintendo's history, you think of the Japanese market, all that stuff, it just, to me, it doesn't really point in the direction of it being that powerful. But you keep getting mm-hmm. these, you know, reports and, you know, the purported leaks and things which point in the direction of it being, you know, or at least some device in the platform family being pretty robustly powerful. I don't know how much credence you really meant to give those reports, but I would lean towards it being more modest, but that's just, you know, a lot of people kind of feel like that would be a mistake, but I'm not so sure about that.
To take the conceit of the email on its face and presume that it is accurate, that there are two or more devices in a family all capable of playing all of the same games. So the Venn diagram for their game libraries are two concentric circles. It's one circle.
Yeah, yeah.
The idea that would be attractive to third parties is presumably there if, let's say, the NX portable were to achieve 3DS-like numbers. Because let's say there were 30 million of the things in the wild. Well, that puts it in the gap between the Xbox One and PS4, closer to the PS4 in numbers. Then, yeah, you would port your game to that. No problem. Assuming it's doable. But I just don't know that Nintendo would build a portable where that's an easy port to do. Like that's the problem with the calculus here. Yes, totally. If the portable could play the same games as the home console, and it's reasonable to assume with Nintendo's, you know, sort of treasury of portable games that they should be able to achieve at least a modestly successful handheld. Granted, the 3DS came out in an era before mobile games became what they were, and it's a different thing now than it was then. Presumably they should be able to be modestly successful, and that may be enough to get attention, but I just don't fundamentally think that's where they're going. But again, play the sirens and the air, you know, the air raid alerts.
We do not currently know what the NX is. We do not currently know what the NX is.
I do think, however, that the NX handheld is important. Well, let me step back. Assuming there is a handheld in the NX family of systems, assuming there is an NX family of systems, assuming we understand what the NX is in some time in the future, the portable space is incredibly important for the home market, obviously. And if they can do things there that make working on the two, you know, a translatable experience, so I know how to make games for Nintendo's portable, therefore I'm well equipped to make games for their home console. Even if I can't make the same games, like I understand the architecture, I understand how to build it, I can reuse a lot of my stuff. Like
definitely the consolidation of their internal development studio suggests that must be happening to some extent. I think
I can reuse middleware and stuff
that would apply to third parties as well.
In Japan, where Capcom's going to keep making Monster Hunter games, and presumably they're going to keep making Monster Hunter games on Nintendo's portable, that would be useful information. If they say, "Hey, we've got this middleware we built; it works on both systems," great. Or if you're a middleware developer, oh, I can make middleware for both in one shot, even better. Because now I can make that and I can put it on the market. And underrated, that would be great for Nintendo if there is a thriving and competitive space for people making middleware for their systems. Because that makes the bar to doing your ports a lot easier. And if you're a middleware manufacturer who's already making middleware for the other platforms, you can say, I get both? Great. I'm going to do this even if these platforms haven't really taken off yet. There's definitely appeal here if these two things can play the same games. But even if they can't, as long as they share something, as if you can translate stuff between them, even if not full games, that's a useful asset for Nintendo to have.
On the point of them sort of milking the Nintendo loyalists again, I mean, you know, I think a lot of people would be more sort of quick to buy like a new 3DS or something if, you know, they kind of felt like they could actually play all their games on that as well as on the old system rather than the either or with the system transfer that we currently have. And of course that presumably is where we're going with My Nintendo, the integrated account and all that, that, you know, whether it would be just virtual console stuff or whether it would be, you know, a subset of the software library that is cross device compatible or whatever, you know, that you would be willing to buy another device because it's like, yeah, well, this is just another way for me to play all the games I've already got, but it adds something to it in some way. You know, maybe they, you know, release iterations that get smaller, they get better screen, you know, the usual kind of stuff, or maybe it's other things like new input types and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, that's always, you know, it's remarkable in a way that Nintendo in their sort of digital phase has probably got the amount of sort of duplicate sales as they have, given that the the account system has been such a limiting sort of thing on their business.
So I did read a business article just recently that talked about the appeal of the closed platforms if you're a platform holder and getting digital conversion, because you can be like Johnny, who went and got an Xbox One in no small part because of his Rock Band library. Mm-hmm. Was it Rock Band or was it Guitar Hero? I can't remember.
It was Rock Band. Yep.
Yeah. Because that shit's tied to your account. And Nintendo, as you said, has not done a good job of that. I think they will on NX, because that way they can say, look, you bought these Wii U games. Do you want to keep them? You got to buy an NX. Or yep. Keep your old Wii U around. And that's a powerful motivator for somebody who spent hundreds of dollars buying digital stuff. Like, that's a...
Yeah. Well, especially when things are roughly the same, if you compare PSN to Xbox Live. I mean, they're roughly the same. Right. There's not...
Especially,
you know,
now.
Yeah. So, it's like something like that can be like, I'll just go with Xbox or whatever.
Right.
Well, and of course, that's the other thing. I mean, what Nintendo has yet to do that people keep suggesting is, you know, a sort of Xbox Live Gold or your PSN Plus type of deal where, you know, you're talking about some kind of rolling subscription that would give you, you know, some sort of access to a library of games or perks or whatever it might be.
It's more games that keep you anchored to their platform too.
And again, yep, that would be more kind of attractive if you might have multiple Nintendo devices, but, you know, that one subscription gives you access to that stuff on all of them at the same time. No transfers, no BS required, you know. So I think that is presumed, gotta be where we're going. Gotta be. So that is the general direction of travel, given what they've done with overall in Club Nintendo, My Nintendo, the Nintendo Network ID, all that stuff. The groundwork seems like it's all been laid, but there is still, of course, a lot we don't know.
Mm-hmm. I don't think Nintendo will do what you just described, because that would mean losing the Pikmin animation of them taking off to a new planet. And
you could always repurpose it somehow.
Did you replace it with Poochies? I'm off to my home planet.
More Simpsons. Right,
let's go ahead with the next email. Guillaume.
Yep. Adrian in the UK writes, "Hi guys, quick question for you all. Is there a piece of console/gaming hardware that you especially identify with? It could be because of software library, hardware features, or marketing. Anything. As long as it makes you think, yep, that sounds like me. Personally, I identify with the Neo Geo systems, because I'm worth it."
Yeah, and if you're British, I mean, the Neo Geo really was a premium option. I mean, that is, he's got a high opinion of himself, let's just put it that way.
He is conceited, is the way we would put it. John, I think you are the first person I want to hear this answer from.
Okay, that I identify with? I don't know in really what way. probably like the Atari 2600, because it's just old, outdated, and people look at it and think, how the hell did people ever do things that way back then?
Oh, I was gonna at least give you an Atari ST. Jeez.
Have you got the wood grain finish, John?
Yeah, of course. That's the only one there is. All the other ones don't matter.
Which console was it that had the analog joysticks that were all loose and not really, you know, didn't you stay up?
Oh, bloody hell. Where's this going?
You know where it's going. Anyway.
John, I don't want to hear any more ED related commentary out of you, Guillaume. What's your console?
Me? I really don't know. Maybe like the clear plastic Game Boy, because I don't get out, so my skin is almost translucent. I don't know. Like, it doesn't, I really don't understand the question.
Your
like,
heart's an open really... book.
You can't take this question seriously, Guillaume.
I guess like the somewhat serious answer is like the Super Famicom, because it's not my first console. It's the NES, but that was, I mean, I was still very young when we got it, and it was, you know, so terribly exciting for a young child to have, and some of my favourite games ever on it. The other answer is the Virtual Boy, because I never had a chance.
I mean, like the Game Boy, because I don't produce my own light.
Really? I'm okay with Guillaume just continuing to answer these, because his answers are just getting worse and better at the same time.
Yeah.
You had 64 because you didn't own yourself. You want me to keep going?
Oh. That's... Wow. So I gave this way too much thought. Way far too much thought. Mm-hmm. And I went ahead and said that I am best described as the Sega Nomad, because it's a lot of ideas that on paper sound really good, but when you actually stop to think about it, what the fuck is anyone thinking right now? And
I see
that pretty well describes a lot of my planning and just my sort of existence.
Demeanor.
Yeah, this sort of ethereal sense of, oh, that makes sense, followed by, wait, what?
I assume the marketing was suitably brash for like that era of Sega as well, sort of loud.
No, it was buried by the marketing for the Saturn.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's a problem, isn't it? It's muddled. Profoundly muddled phase of Sega.
I could have gone with the Neptune in that I never existed, and then I would just cut my audio and do it all just to pretend like I wasn't here anymore.
This question has gotten predictably dark, I think.
I am like the Sega Neptune. My only claim to fame is I inspired a bunch of creepy anime games. There, we're out. Done.
The gaming hardware I'm most like is the Power Glove, because I'm so bad.
All right, that's it. We're done. We're done.
Yep.
We're done.
I'm spent.
We all are after that fucking answer. Zach writes, "Hi guys, love the show. My question is about what doom and gloom that has been." My question is about the doom and gloom that has been festering online ever since Nintendo announced its E3 plans. Certainly, it doesn't look like there's going to be a whole lot of big first-party stuff coming out at the end of the year. What about third-party games? Isn't it true that indie developers fit the definition of third-party? Why do gamers always forget about the smaller, often more enjoyable experiences that seem to never stop hitting the 3DS and Wii U eShop. I recently picked up the Humble Friends of Nintendo bundle. I feel like all of those games, on top of content in Star Fox, I still need to see, along with a few games in my backlog, will keep me more than busy for summer and into the fall. Isn't that all that matters? Do you agree with me that indies should stop being overlooked when we have the tired conversation about Nintendo has no third parties and I'm not reading his sign off? I have standards.
I would if I could.
So it's like discovering the doom and gloom about Nintendo when Nintendo announced their E3 plans tells me that Zach discovered the internet exactly at around that time.
Back at the beginning of May, Zach found out about the internet is what you're telling me.
Exactly.
Go imagine how much more wonderful things he has to discover.
Zach, I'm not gonna say what you should and shouldn't look at on the internet, but for the first few months, keep Safe Search on. That's all I'm gonna say. You gotta ease into this. Are indies third parties? Yes.
Yeah. I think my answer to this would be to the extent that they are sometimes overlooked. There's obvious factors in that, like they don't have huge marketing budgets and all that kind of stuff because they're these small studios.
They don't have huge development budgets either.
Yeah, that too. But certainly to raise awareness of the game. You know, they may be relying on Nintendo sometimes, you know, will sort of put something in a direct or, you know, some other kind of video and stuff, but not everything's going to get that treatment and stuff. So it's only naturally it could be overlooked that way. But the other part of it is, I think sometimes, you know, this doom and gloom stuff, a lot of that comes down to the whole, the kind of console wars type of nonsense, you know? And
yes,
then it's not even so much about, you know, what's being talked about in this email, which is about the bread and butter, like what am I actually playing on the console, what kind of enjoyment am I getting out of it. It's like the strategic importance of it. It's like, well, you haven't got any strategically important third parties that show that you are a real console and you know, have robust support and the market believes in you and you can have all the big hitters on your side kind of thing. That's a whole other separate thing from just the simple bread and butter, what do I actually play on the damn thing? You know, and I guess that's still, I feel like that hasn't been as relevant for Nintendo, the Nintendo community for a while, because it's kind of sidestepped that, you know, direct kind of competition for a while, but it's still out there.
Well, it's still relevant, though, in terms of, like, am I going to be able to play the big games that came out this year? And the answer is, unless Nintendo made them, no. So if you want to play the big sort of games that are taking all the oxygen out of the room, you have to either own a PC that can play them or one of the other two consoles. That's just...
Yep.
And when people say third party, that's what they mean. They're talking about these big, you know, sort of
major
all-encompassing...
Games, yeah.
Right, they're talking about like The Witcher 3 at the end of last year.
Yeah, third party specifically.
Right.
Yeah, and because people just don't get, people in general, I don't mean like people like us who are really into the hobby, but most people don't really care about the indie titles. So you go to something like the PlayStation blog when they announce the free games that you get off PSN, PS Plus, and if it's a bunch of indie games, you get a whole lot of replies to the blog post complaining about it. Just like, oh, it's shit again. And it might be like Axiom Verge. It might be a very celebrated indie title. But, you know, for most people, it's like, no, I don't want this garbage.
Well, I mean, and to be fair, if you looked at something that was a PS4 game originally, was developed from the ground up as a PS4 game, you know, with cutting edge visuals and stuff, and then looked at something like Axiom Verge next to each other, you'd go, whoa, one of these looks super primitive. And if that's all you've got to go on, you're right. It does. It does. It looks super primitive because it is visually primitive. That's part of its aesthetic. That's what it's going for. But if that doesn't resonate with you, if you weren't playing games of the Super Nintendo era and that you have no nostalgia for that, you look at that and go, damn, he didn't have a budget, did he? Because damn, one dude made that game. Yeah, it's not going to have.
Yeah.
I mean, artistically, it was going for something, but also, a lot of these indie games use pixel graphics, not because it's cutting edge anymore, because too many of them use pixel graphics at this point for it to be. It's because it's cheaper.
Yep.
It's a lot cheaper.
And it takes a lot less time to make.
That is part of you know, the things you do when you are making a game with one or two or three people. And those games are important and they matter. Well, some of them are important and some of them matter. Legend of the Dark Witch is not one of them, but like those other games matter too. And you need to have some balance of both if you want to be, you know, taken seriously as this, as a major player in the industry right now. Because guess what? Xbox One and PS4 have most of these indie games too. But
yeah,
right.
They also have, you know, the new Red Dead that's not been announced yet that's coming out. They're going to have that. They're going to have the next GTA game. They're going to have the next Call of Duty. They're going to have the next Madden. They're going to have the next FIFA. These games are going to exist on their platform in conjunction with these indie games. And that's the gap that Nintendo is dealing with. And that's where the doom and gloom comes from. When you go to the Ubisoft press conference.
That's why people buy these consoles. I mean, people are going to want, oh, I like, you know, whatever first-party Sony game comes out. But then they also want Madden. They want FIFA. They want those kinds of games.
I want to climb fucking towers. So I need my games that let me do that. Well, right now you can't climb towers on the Wii U. I'm sorry. Nope. You're going to have to stay on the ground. So there is a gap there. And while some of the doom and gloom is hyperbolic, at a minimum would be the description for it. It is not necessarily coming entirely from a place of just rampant negativity either. There is a real problem. And I think the last email spoke to just our general insanity. The email prior to that speaks to it, because the appeal he was speaking of for having this kind of unified platform is that, oh, third parties will be back because they want to sell their games. Well, maybe. But only if it's viable for them to do it and there's a base there to sell them on. And that's important. Establishing a base on a system that can play these games is what Nintendo needs to do. And hopefully they can. And that's where the doom and gloom comes from. Because right now, the Wii U can't do either. It can't play these cutting-edge games, and it doesn't have the base to make it worth making for them anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, ultimately, that hurts it as a product.
Totally. It means
not as good of a product.
Right. People, even if it could play those games, the people who own it aren't able to play those games because they're not there.
Yep.
A video game console is only as good as the games that are available for it. You can have the most cutting edge technology, but if your like exclusive games are that Yakuza based driving game for the Xbox, who fucking cares? That game was terrible.
Yeah. Yep.
The secret missions or something like that.
Well, I think but it's an important point that Guillaume made, I think, because it says that this is not the kind of quote unquote overlooking of indie developers and things is not something that exists only on Nintendo's platform. You know, as he said, you know, there's a broader perception issue of just like, oh, well, you know, for a lot of people who buy consoles, they don't necessarily buy that many games for it. It is going to be the top line stuff, you know, the stuff that has the biggest brands attached to it and all that kind of stuff. They're never going to drill down that far to get to indie stuff. You know, but of course with Nintendo, if you overlook indies, then it's this, the issue of like, well, if you overlook indies, there really isn't much else third party stuff. But, you know, it depends whether you're looking at it in terms of the overall kind of outlook for the platform and its welfare and how well it's going to perform in the market, or whether you're looking at a micro level and in terms of someone's own experience. Because I mean, the thing about third-party development that's also important is about giving you a range of different experiences on the platform. You know, how many different kinds of games can you play? Are you going to have kind of a balanced gaming diet on a particular platform? And Nintendo, you know, does a pretty good job of having all these partners that they work with and their own output about making, you know, a diverse bunch of games, but they can't do everything. So, you know, third parties are often going to be able to sort of fill those gaps and give you, you know, kinds of experiences that Nintendo either just don't try to, or they do it in a different way, or whatever. And I guess the thing is, I mean, with indies, they can actually fulfill that same kind of function to some extent. They can make games, you know, that Nintendo wouldn't make that, you know, fill a particular kind of need in your gaming appetite. However, you know, to a large extent, you know, like you said, because they kind of favor, especially given the market that exists on Wii U, you know, like 2D games, sprite art, all that kind of stuff. there's, you know, they kind of also tend to dovetail with things that do well on Nintendo's market anyway. So,
right. Yeah, often these developers have grown up playing Nintendo games and are aping them.
Yeah.
Like we mentioned, Axiom Verge, you know.
Yep. Yeah, they could still
Which
put
no
their
one
own spin
on
it. They can put, you know, something valuable to it that wouldn't have happened if it was just another Nintendo product or whatever. Or, you know, they could go on to tackle genres that maybe Nintendo's not as big into, all that. But it still doesn't serve the same function as especially the big Western third party publishers that deal in genres that Nintendo generally doesn't. You know, obviously Nintendo skews more to the genres that the Japanese market is more comfortable with. With some exceptions, you've seen it branching out a bit, maybe something like Splatoon, where they've actually managed to sell a shooter in Japan on a tiny platform,
totally.
which is a great accomplishment. But yeah, I think that's for the individual consumer, I think that's arguably where if you were in a position where you're either just weren't going to buy another console, you couldn't afford it practically or whatever, or you were very disinclined to, I think that's where you feel the absence of those third parties. It's just that particular kinds of experience, that require big production values and all this kind of stuff, that you're not Nintendo can't fill that gap. That's not what they do, so, and then indies can't really do it either because they're not big enough. So there is a legitimate point there about a sort of a deficiency in the library that might not really affect people equally. I can't say, I have an Xbox One, but I don't buy that many of the big franchise games because I'm just not really into those. GTA, that kind of thing, I'm just not that into those myself, so I don't really feel that pinch very much personally, but I could see the void is there.
Yeah. And you can buy those games if you want, if you ever want to dabble in them.
Well, yeah, I have that luxury. I mean, some people might not.
Yep.
Yeah, yep. And I understand where Zach is coming from. Like, he's coming from, a place where, like, he wants to be satisfied with what he has, and I get that. Like, that's kind of how I approach my gaming as well. And, like, E3, I'm not terribly upset about because it's never really been... It's always been a marketing thing, right? And I've always been more interested in what I have in front of me, but... That's the thing, though. Like, as we've pointed out, the games that we're not seeing today, we're not going to get our hands on tomorrow. So,
right. The game that doesn't exist, you can't play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I understand. And, like, we've been talking about the broad user base and stuff like that. And I think Zach is more concerned about, his tastes and, like, he's satisfied with the Wii U.
Yeah.
And that's great. Like, that's awesome.
No, I agree. But I think the point as well is that, with indie games, it's not really about, they don't get overlooked because of their, intrinsic quality, how well designed they are. They get overlooked because they don't have the marketing, they don't have the budget, they don't have
the
scope.
They're just not as loud.
Yeah, they're not as loud.
Yeah.
And you could look at that as being unfair, to some extent, I guess, perhaps, but it's just the way of things. The same is true in the music industry, the film industry. I mean, this is just...
Literature?
Yeah, sure. Any kind of medium you want to know, these sorts of concerns come into play. So, I don't think you should really... Like you said, I guess if you have just discovered the internet... Then if you're reading these blog, Guillaume's talking about with the PlayStation blog, people shitting on indie games because it's not the free game.
Every time.
Not the free game they wanted this month. I can understand having this kind of reaction because it just seems like, this is totally out of whack. It's not justified at all.
Well, yeah, but don't sweat too much what people write about on the internet. Also, Ants 2, best ski snowboarding game of 2002. So,
let us be the first ones to tell you don't read the comments.
Yeah.
Especially
if you're new to the internet.
But please leave comments on our article for our podcast.
That's right. Leave comments on our show. Just don't read any comments around them.
Don't read them.
Yep. So just post in a complete vacuum. We'll read them for you.
By the way, speaking of indie games being overlooked, right? I offered 4 codes from my Humble Bundle purchase.
You did,
and I said, just throw in a favorite RFM memory if you're from Europe, and you could get one of Affordable Space Adventures, Freedom Planet, Shantae and the Pirate's Curse for 3DS and Wii U separately. No takers. None.
And you bastards have no favorite memories. So,
I'm taking it. Basically, everyone in Europe has either has these games already, or they, you know, so let's hope, pray to God it's that. Or they have no good memories of RFM whatsoever. Or maybe they just, you know, to Zach's point, they just spit on indie games. I don't know. None of them are particularly
You can lie to us. It doesn't have to be your favorite memory. You can say that time that John talked about Voodoo Vince is your favorite. John doesn't own Voodoo Vince. He doesn't even know what platform it's for. I don't care. I'm giving you a fucking code.
That Jewel Thief movie. Just write into RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com, say something, I'll probably give you a code at this point. That's where we are.
List your favorite Xbox exclusive game, original Xbox exclusive. I don't give a shit. I've been naming them for the last 5 minutes. If you can't just pick one out of the show, you're fine. Bruce Lee, Quest of the Dragon. Okay, that's going to do it for email this week. You can send your email to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com and we'll probably give you a code because, for God's sake, people, we're trying to make this easy.
You have to be the European codes.
You can lie to us. Tell us you're European.
Help us.
But then it just won't work.
Help us give you something for free. Oh... I want to quick follow up. Next week we are doing Castlevania Rondo of Blood retroactive. We put it off a week. I have now playing the game. I am a little ways in. It's not super long. It's a lot easier than you're probably expecting it to be.
Yeah, it definitely.
It does get trickier later, but it's not like the masochism of some other Castlevania games.
You got the Maria ripcord. You can always.
That's right. She's got cats. We can do this. We could do this together. We can kill Dracula for the 37th time. So go ahead and get killing Dracula and post your comments in the talkback thread. We will be talking about this game next week. So hurry and get those comments in before next Thursday. I'm digging this game a lot. It's a weird hybrid of like Castlevania 4 and some earlier stuff. So it'll be cool. We'll talk about it then. Greg, what is our ending music this week?
Well, ending music this week was suggested by Mass Till. I have no idea if that's the correct way to pronounce it, but it's a little going to get a bit spiritual here with something from Opuna, the Wii game from years past, called The Holy Spring. You'll see what I mean when you hear it.
Excellent. And on that, we'll do it for this week. Bye, everybody.
Later.
Bye.
Bye.